I realized that Britain must be on the verge of a financial collapse. And as I looked into it, you know, all the telltale signs are there. And I published an article titled, I think, The Coming Collapse of Britain. And that was on 26th August. And then the very next day, on 27th August, Keir Starmer, the prime minister, made a speech in the garden of 10 Downing Street, in which he announced that his government had...
Alex Craner, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me, Andy. Warm greetings from Monaco to your viewers and listeners.
Well, warm greetings from Atlanta, Georgia to you and Monaco. I think Monaco might be a little warmer. So Tom Luongo name dropped you. I was familiar with a lot of your work and a lot of your perspectives, but he made an intro to us, and I'm very grateful to him for that. And really, let's start with the geopolitics, the geopolitical chessboard, if you would. Just really, where are we at? And specifically, where is Europe at and fitting in all of this? Just want your perspective.
Well, in one word, trouble. Europe is in trouble. I think a lot of factors came together. And I'm suspecting that this could prove to be the worst crisis that we even know from history books, because I don't know that any previous generation of the ruling establishment has been quite so insane as the current one. You know, we had the COVID pandemic, which went along with absolutely insane countermeasures, which have carried a massive, massive economic cost. But even that was preceded by gathering net zero decarbonization measures. Then we had, at the very same time, an accelerating ramp up in uncontrolled immigration into Europe. Tens of millions of migrants flooded the continent, including the UK, Ireland, and elsewhere. And then we had the governments, the states, developing these systems of control, like track and trace in the UK. Preparations that were made for the COVID pass and so forth. They made the same preparations for the introduction of CBDCs. Nothing much has come off it, but you know, this has been tens of billions of dollars that were invested in that. And then, along with all that, they spent hundreds of billions of dollars on Project Ukraine. And I think that no government has been more prolific in all this than the British government. And so this has been a massive sequence of malinvestment, absolutely colossal misallocation of resources into things that will result in a whole lot of nothing, but actually social uprisings across Europe. And now we see that happening in the UK. And I think that this is the reason why last month, Keir Starmer government, they barely took power. They went with this very draconian, Nazi-like system of repression, crackdown on free speech, and, you know, restrictions on people's ability to gather, to protest, to express themselves freely, and so forth, right in the heart of what's supposed to be one of the world's leading democracies, where you have human rights reigning sacrosanct rule of law and order and so forth. And so I had to ask myself, why is this? What is going on? And why now? Because all of these pretexts are nothing new, really. This has been going on for many, many, many years. And then, finally, in a few brainstorming podcasts with Tom, I realized that Britain must be on the verge of a financial collapse. And as I looked into it, you know, all the telltale signs are there. And I published an article titled, I think, The Coming Collapse of Britain. And that was on 26th August. And then the very next day, on 27th August, Keir Starmer, the prime minister, made a speech in the garden of 10 Downing Street, in which he announced that his government had uncovered a £22 billion black hole in British public finances. And okay, so that's all very bad, except that same Keir Starmer, when he was in opposition on May 1, said in Parliament that the black hole was actually £46 billion. And then he corrected himself and said it was actually £64 billion. And then he corrected himself again and said it was £71 billion. Okay, now that he's in power, we're down to 22. I think that the point of all this is that things are really bad, but they are not nearly as bad as what we don't know. So that was a double negative, I think. Things are a lot worse than we know. And so, you know, we're coming to that point in history where something bad's about to go down. And I think that it's going to be bad enough that it's worth paying attention to. It's going to be one of those things that'll be in history curricula, like, you know, like the 1929 stock market crash or 1921 Weimar Republic hyperinflation or the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think that bad, which, you know, at the same time is something that's going to affect us all badly, because it's not just going to be Britain. It's going to be probably Australia and Canada in the same go, and Europe. And I think that the same storm is coming from the United States. Only I believe that the United States will be able to weather the crisis a bit better than these old oligarchic colonial powers on the old continent. Anyway, so, you know, that I think is the one that's worth paying attention to, because, you know, as they say, where there's a crisis, there's also a opportunity.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm taking notes here just to follow up with some questions here. I think it's key that you say you're asking yourself, you and Tom, why now and why is this happening? So if we could unpack that a little bit, why now?
Okay, so Britain has been one of the world's, I would say, the leading cheerleader for the Project Ukraine. In fact, the more you look into it, the more you see that the British are absolutely in the driver's seat, and they are lobbying and coercing everybody to, you know, expand the wars, to escalate tensions, to go all in against Russia and so forth. And they have spent tremendous amounts of money on this. Not only in terms of direct investment, you know, well, what are we talking about? About $10 billion worth of military aid and about $5 or $6 billion in financial aid. We're also talking about indirect costs, because the cost of energy has shot tremendously. The cost of sanctions against Russia, we don't really know what they are. I do remember that in June 2023, Europe's High Commissioner for Foreign Affairs, Joseph Borrell, ran his mouth, and he said that the cost of sanctions has been 10 times what Europe has provided in terms of military and financial aid to Ukraine. And the number he was talking about was 700 billion euros. And so I'm thinking if that's consistent with what the UK has experienced, then maybe we're talking 150 billion pounds in addition to the 15 billion pounds that they spent. And then, you know, what does this look like? Well, the cost of energy. I've heard farmers complain that the cost of fertilizer has gone from 250 pounds a ton to 1,000 pounds a ton. The cost of heating, the cost of electricity, you know, a lot of small and medium-sized businesses have been absolutely devastated. And this comes on the back of all the pandemic countermeasures. Mm-hmm. And so I think that whatever black hole is there is probably a lot larger than we know, but we don't know the full extent of it. We just know that Keir Starmer said it was 22 billion pounds. It's probably, you know, if you want to be conservative, probably double that. And then he's been repeating this theme of a quote unquote deep rot at the heart of British public finances. And then he has also prepared the nation for the October 30th budget, which, you know, we'll find out when we find out. But he said that it would be extremely painful. And so what does that mean?
Austerity.
That means savage austerity.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, we have to point out that the Bank of England has started a process for quantitative easing through a repo program. So they announced this repo program on 22nd July. Oh, yeah. And then before, just to wrap up with Ukraine, Ukraine actually, this wasn't really registered in the mainstream media, but Ukraine actually defaulted because on 31st July, Volodymyr Zelensky announced a freeze on all payments of foreign debts. So that was supposed to be a temporary measure for 2 or 3 months, but I don't see how they're going to be able to, you know, like if they're unable to service foreign debts now, I don't think what changes in 2 or 3 months. You know, this is going to be one of those temporary measures like Richard Nixon decoupling of dollars convertibility to gold. You know, 50 years later, it was never reversed. So I don't think this is a temporary thing. So I think that Ukraine's default has probably pushed Britain over the edge, you know, because all of their investments there are now bad debt. And so, you know, when you have a lot of bad debt in the system, what happens? Well, the central bank has to go to QE. And so this is where the Bank of England's sudden radical new thinking about providing reserves to the system comes into play. And last news I read about the repo program in the UK is that it has ballooned to 40 billion pounds. And this was on September 5th. We are now September 17th. So I think it's probably grown a lot bigger by now. Anyway, you know, so I've been kind of paying attention to Britain for a few years now. And the first time I published anything about it was in October 2021, so almost 3 years ago. And so I made a prediction. I made a concrete prediction about this. And I said that the Britain is probably going to make all the mistakes that were made by all the declining powers through history, which means that they will not be able to handle the debt overhang, that they will implement savage austerity at home, which will suffocate economic growth. And now we know from OECD that Britain is expected to be the worst economic performer among developed nations for this year and for the next one. And that the only way to backstop these bad debts and prevent from system from collapsing will be by the central bank going into a QE mode, which came true as well. And then the result of all this is going to be a long, very painful period of stagflation, which might with time morph into hyperinflation. And so, you know, these are the events that, you know, one needs to prepare for, particularly if you have exposure to British pound or other British, you know, British debt.
My question then would be, so this is obviously will spill into the continent of Europe, and it looks like they're already softening up as far as quantitative easing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but spilling over into the U.S., why has the Fed not been more? And I'm saying this as a statement of fact, not a judgment. Why hasn't the Fed been more easy with the money, right, as of right now? If that makes
sense. I think we're entering into Tom Luongo's domain here, and I'm not sure, you know, because, you know, the facts you can read from, you know, the Feds and the government statistics suggest that they should have been a bit more easy with the money. Now, have they been or have they not been? I don't really know, because I think there's a lot of evidence that some of the monetary policy is being conducted in a covert way.
Yeah.
Say, you know, the Fed will, you know, like an illusionist, they will be showing you this hand, but the other hand is going to be doing something else. Yeah. And so I think that in, you know, like in concert with the Bank of Japan, with maybe other central banks around the world, you know, the Belgians, the Luxembourg, whoever, I don't know, they've been maybe providing liquidity to the U.S. system. And we have seen actually that the bank reserves in the U.S. systems, in the U.S. system have now been growing again. But, you know, there's still, you know, the narrative is still, we might loosen up, but we don't know, and maybe sometimes in the future, whereas they're maybe already doing it, you know. And then, you know, there's also these geopolitical considerations where it seems that there's maybe some kind of a civil war going on within the very banking cartel that's controlling the central banks, that the, you know, there's some kind of faction in the U.S., and then there's a faction of these old European banking families, and that they're to an extent at loggerheads, and that perhaps the Fed keeping things tight at home is putting these European central banks in difficulty, which means that it might precipitate a collapse in Europe sooner, providing an opportunity for the United States to bail itself out at Europe's expense, and then for the American banking establishment to kind of impose itself and to subordinate the European bankers to itself. So I think these are kind of things where you have to do a lot of imaginative dot connecting, but some of this is almost certainly going on. I just don't know, you know, it's a bit fuzzy to me. And I think that Tom Luongo has been great on this. And for about 2 or 3 years that I've been following his analysis, he's been largely spot on.
Yeah, no, he has. But getting back to Ukraine, if you would, it was one, let me just make a statement. It was interesting to me just how peace was, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, peace was on the table soon after this war started. And it was the Brits, which is very interesting, and the Americans that they didn't want peace. They wanted escalation, or they didn't want it to continue. So it just, yeah, just, it's interesting the role that Britain played in continuing the war, if you would.
Well, you see, what happened is that when the Russians launched their special military operation on, what was it, 2022 or 28 February 2022?
Yeah.
They started talking to the Ukrainians within 4 days. Mm-hmm. And so the negotiations between the Russians and the Ukrainians started almost immediately. And by late April 2022, only a few weeks into the special military operation, they already had a very detailed document initialed, ready for signing. The only thing that remained controversial was the status of Ukraine, but they kind of agreed to resolve that issue over the following 10 years, you know, in order to be able to sign some kind of a ceasefire and a peace, and then deal with the difficult stuff later. And then Boris Johnson parachuted into Kiev, unannounced practically, and said, no, you're not doing this. We're going to war. We're going to back you all the way. You know, everybody tends to say that, oh, the Americans sent Boris Johnson to Kiev. And I think, like, why would the Americans send Boris Johnson? You know, the Americans have a lot of representatives in Kiev already, including the ambassador. Then, you know, Victoria Nuland was still the assistant secretary of state. This was right up her alley. They could have said, sent Victoria Nuland. They could have sent Antony Blinken. Why would they say Boris Johnson of all people? And so I don't think it was the Biden administration that sent Boris Johnson. I think it was whoever has Boris Johnson on the strings sent Boris Johnson. Again, you know, if you look close into how this whole thing started, you get a very, very strong impression that Britain is leading the game. And it was, in fact, Boris Johnson who kind of pre-announced the war, because he gave a speech on the 15th November, 2021. Yeah, just a few months before the special military operation began. He gave a speech in the city of London in which he said that, addressing the European leaders, he said, we hope that our friends in Europe will recognize that a choice is shortly coming between mainlining vast amounts of Russian cheap hydrocarbons or standing up for peace and stability in Ukraine. So how he knew that this choice was shortly coming, I don't know. It's a mystery, but he did know it. And, you know, the warning appropriately was issued from the city of London. And I do believe that the city of London is still, you know, the ideological and psychological and strategic headquarters of the Western Empire that the neocons in the U.S. administration are, you know, their agents in the United States. But, you know, the United States is being dragged through this, not so much reluctantly, because there are a lot of interests in the United States that are keenly interested in the outcome of Ukraine war, you know, namely the banking establishment and the military industrial complex in particular. But this is not an American project. You know, this is only a segment of the American political class that's involved in this. And then there's, you know, the U.S. Republic, the ordinary people, the legitimate democratic structures of the United States, who are thinking, like, why on earth are we even doing this? And then you keep seeing these British, how do you call them, diplomatic representatives, intelligence service representatives, prime ministers, defense ministers, foreign ministers, keep jetting around to the United States to try to keep the U.S. on board with the project. But I think that the country that's most on the hook of all is Great Britain.
Got it. So let's play this thesis out then. Great Britain then, according to what you're saying, and I say that with endearment, it's going to be hitting the fan here in the next 6 to 8 weeks with the new budget, and they're going to be seeing a lot of austerity. They're obviously not going to like that, and business is going to further implode, or what business is left. Let's make that leap then. Does that leap over then to the continent of Europe, and what countries? Because I'm assuming the biggest trade partners with Great Britain are not only the U.S., but also the continent, Europe. So who's going to be really affected by that, I guess, is my question.
Okay, so I would, you know, the prediction I had made back in 21 is that what we're going to end up getting is stagflation with high inflation. So it's going to affect everybody pretty much, you know. I think that, you know, if you look at the chart of, I predicted high inflation, stagnation for the economy, collapse of the British pound, and the collapse of the British gilt. This has been pretty much going on since 2021.
Yeah.
But over the last few months, the British pound has actually been gaining strength, and the gilts have been gaining strength. So the interest rate on those have been going down. The reason is because, you know, when you announce austerity, the investor class tend to like that. It gives them confidence that the government is going to be running a tight ship and conservative policy and so on. So they kind of gain confidence in the currency and in the sovereign debt. And so that's kind of favoring the British public finances marginally up until they announce this budget, which at that point, God knows what's going to happen. But at the same time, you know, this austerity is what's suffocating economic growth in the UK. Mm-hmm. And so longer term, the government is still not going to be able to fund its budget. The bad debts are still going to be bad. They're not going to magically win in Ukraine and possess themselves of Ukrainian, natural resources for new money, good collateral to refloat the financial system again. So it's downhill as far as the eye can see. I don't think that Europe is in a significantly better position because the Europeans have been following the exact same playbook as the UK. So they've been shoveling money into net zero, into these pandemic countermeasures, into the Project Ukraine, into immigration. So everything is all the same. It's just that Europe is a bit of a bigger economy than the UK. It's not quite so focused on just a handful of these things. And so I think that Europe will follow the UK with a bit of a lag. So again, who's going to be impacted the most? Again, everybody, but in what sequence? You know, because if you're British defense establishment, mm-hmm. the good times are starting because, you know, as at the same time as Keir Starmer is announcing austerity, mm-hmm. and he's cutting the old people's heating allowances, the heating subsidies, which they know that about 4,000 pensioners will die of hypothermia. They know this. So they're going ahead with this anyway. At the same time, they're promising continued support to Ukraine and even increasing it. And at the same time, they're adding about £3 billion to the defense budget, which is about 4.5%. So if you're in the defense establishment, you're doing well. If you're in the financial industry, you're doing well because Bank of England is splurging all the quantitative easing that you're going to ever need. They said they would accept any kind. They haven't used those words, but the implication is exactly that, that they will be accepting any kind of toxic pledge as money good collateral, and they're going to be giving you pound for pound for the value of it, probably including the Ukraine bonds. And so I think that you're in trouble if you're an independent business, if you're a small or medium-sized company, if you don't have government contracts, and if you depend on fixed income. So that means pretty much ordinary people and ordinary entrepreneurs.
Yeah. The middle class, really.
The middle class, yes.
Yeah. So where does natural resource come into all of this? And you made a comment at the beginning of this conversation about similar to the fall of the Soviet Union. And I I'm assuming we're about the same age. I'm 50 years old, and I lived through that, but I lived through it differently than you. You were across the pond, if you would. But I just remember all of these oligarchs, if you would, or they weren't oligarchs. They were former members of the government. went and bought up all the assets very, very cheap, the natural resources, and they became oligarchs. Is that, you see what's going to happen, because there's so many assets that are cheap. I mean, I'm just looking at crude oil, or I should say West Texas oil in the U.S. here, and it's so cheap relative to inventory levels. So, yeah, I guess that is my question. Where do you see natural resources play in all of this? And do you see this as a grab bag, somebody coming in and swooping them up cheap?
Well, I am generally a strong believer in the commodity super cycle hypothesis. I think we're going into a commodity super cycle, which is, you know, something that might span anything between 10 years and 25 years historically.
25 years. Wow. I'm not laughing at you. I'm just like, that's crazy. That's awesome.
That's been the historical, how do you call it? Based on historical precedents, you know, there are these massive cycles. And I think, you know, we recently hit a 50-year low in the ratio between the valuation of equities versus commodities. So commodities super cheap, equities super in the bubble territory. And so what happens over the next 10 years or 25 years or anything in between there is that either we're going to see the equities come down considerably, or we're going to see commodities go up considerably, or, you know, both possibly.
Right.
And, you know, I also have to say that the precedents we have for these commodity super cycle sequences are all based on the last 150 years. And the last 150 years is more or less all within the same system of governance that has been defined by the British, by the British Empire to this day, you know. And what that has entailed is that you always suppressed commodity prices so that you can obtain them from your colonies at rock bottom prices, right?
Yep.
And so we've consistently seen that commodities exporting nations have always been mired in poverty for some reason. You know, it's not a coincidence. It's a deliberate policy. Today, we have the rise of China, which has a very, very different strategy. The Chinese want to raise the whole global South out of poverty because China has positioned itself as the global manufacturing hub of the world. And they want to have a couple of billion people in the world who are affluent enough to buy their stuff, right? So, you know, instead of the, you know, global ruling establishment systematically suppressing economic growth and development in commodity exporting nations, you're going to have the opposite, where the Chinese deliberately want those economies to develop and to become more prosperous and to absorb a lot of that commodity production locally. And so I think that you know, the end of British system and the beginning of the new system, which is, you know, whatever, call it Chinese if you like, is going to put an additional upward pressure on commodities. So the next bull cycle in commodities could be bigger than what we've seen the last 150 years.
Wow.
And so I think that, you know, adding exposure to commodity markets to your investment portfolio is something that people should look into generally in the future. I'm not just talking about buying the stocks of oil producers and gold miners and so forth, but to actually gain exposure to the prices themselves through, you know, through future contracts, through mini futures, whatever you can trade. See, you know, I don't think CFDs are legal in the United States. These are contracts for differences, which are synthetic trading instruments, but you can gain exposure to things like oil and gold and coffee and cocoa and so forth in relatively small denominations. So if you want to buy a contract of oil futures, you have to buy 1,000 barrels, which means that what you have to cash out $70,000-$75,000 today. Whereas with CFDs, you can buy 10 barrels, you know, I don't know, it depends on the broker, but usually it's in very, very small denominations. So it's not very difficult to gain exposure to those. Now, you know, these things are kind of like you could gain access to a motorcycle. it's great. It gets you from point A to point B. It's doing what it's meant to do. But if you press on the accelerator too hard, you're going to get into trouble. You're going to get hurt.
There's a lot of risk.
Very careful. And I think that in the United States, maybe the easiest way to gain exposure to commodity prices are ETFs. So you can find, if you can find good ETFs with, you know, exposure to energy commodities, to agricultural commodities, to metals, industrial and precious, I think that there's a good case to make an allocation to those funds.
Is there a specific commodity group, if you would, whether that's metals, energy, agriculture, industrial metals, whatever, that you prefer over the others right now?
Not necessarily. You know, gold has done really, really well. Just now, recently, it hit all-time highs a day before yesterday, I think, on Friday, perhaps, 13th September.
Yeah.
And I think maybe it rose even a little bit higher yesterday. But it's hard to say because, you know, at the same time, silver, it doesn't matter what happened up until this day because it's too late. You can't make those decisions fast. What matters is what's going to happen over the next 12 months or, you know, 10 years. And so in that sense, you know, I think the best way to go is to be as diversified as possible because you cannot predict which commodity is going to be doing the best. And even, you know, with respect to gold, we've seen over the last 2-3 years that whereas gold has formed this beautiful uptrend, silver has barely moved. It's still not bridged 2022 highs. It's kind of stuck. It's moved a bit higher, but it's stuck. So maybe silver will do better than gold over the next few years. Palladium and platinum have done absolutely nothing. They look like they're dead. You know, they're trading very near to their historic lows. So I think it's impossible to predict which commodity will do best. So the best way to go about it is to be diversified, you know, have some, you know, have an allocation to agricultural commodities, have some assets in, have some money in metals, and have some money in energy, definitely. I think maybe, you know, with a strategic view, maybe energy is really, really important. I don't know if it's going to underperform or outperform, whatever, but it is going to be extraordinarily important.
Got it. Let's talk here about your work here. Sure. I know you've written several books. How can people find those? And if people want to know more about you and potentially do business with you or reach out to you, how do they do that?
I'm easy to find on Twitter, on X. So my handle is @NakedHedgy. I actually just got locked out of my account today. And the reason why I got locked out, you know, yesterday, Thierry Breton, I have to share this story. Thierry Breton, who is European Union's, you could call him censorship czar. Yeah.
I was going to say censorship.
Yeah. Censorship czar. He handed in his resignation, I think, just yesterday.
He did. Yep.
And, you know, I tweeted his announcement. I retweeted his announcement and saying like, oh, that's a shame. I would have loved the opportunity to tar and feather you and run you out of town on a rail. But I guess, you know, just you spending more time with your family is a win, is a big win for all the rest of us. And for that, I got locked out of my account. And they're like, we might unlock you in a week, but it could take longer. I'm like, what did I say?
Yeah.
And so I guess, yeah, I'm there, but for the moment, I can use Twitter as read only for the next week or so. I also publish a Substack. My Substack is Alex Craner's Trend Compass. And I've kind of really liked the Substack. I've published there for the last 2 years. And now I'm really thinking about using Substack for my business newsletters, because what I do is I publish a daily trend following newsletter called iSystem Trend Compass. And it's a bit of a costly service, but I think that if I put it on Substack, I'll be able to reduce the price very considerably. And so I'm thinking about going with a US portfolio, which will cover, you know, the main United States indices like NASDAQ, S&P 500, Russell, and the 10-year note, the 30-year treasury bond, US dollar yen, US dollar euro, gold and silver. And then I'm also thinking about making a major markets portfolio, which will also include the UK, because, you know, because here's the problem. You know, we can predict certain things kind of in the distant future, in the sense that we can see that there's this crisis of stagflation and inflation and commodity super cycle coming in the following years. But you can't say when the trend might emerge, how long it might go for, how fast it's going to grow or collapse. And so I've learned to believe in systematic trend following, where an algorithm tells me, now buy, now sell. And I've been doing this for more than 20 years. And I believe in that because it kind of helps you not have to predict things and be right. And it also enables you to follow a large number of markets that you couldn't otherwise focus on, you know, because, you know, like maybe people know US stocks or they know European stocks. But, you know, how do you trade copper? How do you trade oil? How do you trade gold and silver? How do you trade US treasuries or British gilts and so forth? So, you know, if you have an algorithm that's looking at all these things and that's not diluted in terms of focus and attention, then that's a better way, and it's more consistent. And then, you know, then you have to manage your risk, because like with the vehicles, you know, you don't want to press the accelerator too aggressively. Yeah. So basically, you know, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is @NakedHedgy. A Substack, it's Alex Craner's Trend Compass. And then my, you know, for investors and traders, my website is iSystem Trend Following. And there, you know, that people can find about the newsletter, about turnkey portfolio solutions, and about commodity and FX price hedging services.
Excellent. And I'll put all of these links in the show notes below this talk. Real quick, you've written a couple of books. Should people buy those on Amazon?
No, Amazon canceled me completely.
I heard.
And so they deleted all my work. They deleted all the reviews. And then they continued selling one of my books for something like $900 a copy. But, you know, I didn't see any of that money. And so I decided at that point to put both my trading books online for free, so people can download them as free downloads. And they're not free because they're crap. One of my first book, called Mastering Uncertainty in Commodities Trading, actually got an award as the best book for commodities trading for investors and traders in 2021 and 2022. But the newer title, which is called Alex Craner's Trend Following Bible, to my, you know, it's didn't get any awards, but I think is a better text. So people can find those books as free downloads on my website, iSystem Trend Following. you go to the About tab, and then if you scroll down, you find the download buttons for both books. And I, again, the Trend Following Bible, I think, is the better of the two if you'll choose one.
Excellent. Again, I'll put all of this, link to all of this in the show notes, both on YouTube as well as the podcast. Alex, I think we'll wrap it up there. I just want to thank you so much for your time. You had great insights, and you've been incredibly gracious with me trying to get you on. So I just want to thank you for that.
Andy, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. And again, a warm greetings to your viewers and listeners.
Thank you, Alex.
Take care.